Thank you so much. It's great to be with so many people that I agree with. It's a nice feeling in this town when that happens, I tell you. And this is an issue that, at least in the past, has crossed party lines. This is an issue that has been something that at least I hoped and thought, General, that we're beyond questioning the need for the Violence Against Women Act. You know, I can remember as vividly as it was yesterday, when way back in the 80s, I, as chairman of the Judiciary Committee, got a report from what the general will tell you is called the Bureau of Justice Statistics. And I saw that while violence crime against men in this period, we all talked about violent crime and the effect of cocaine and all the thing and all these things about and crack and how gratuitous violence was manifesting itself in ways we hadn't seen, that although violent crime, I thought, was rising relative to everyone, it was actually trending down for men. It was trending down for young men between the ages of 18 and 30. But violent crime, according to statistics, was actually up as it related to women over the same period of time. You know, and I can remember thinking to myself, how in God's name is that? How do you explain that? And literally, as some of you in this audience who were with me, or I should say I was with you from the beginning, we actually resolved we were going to do something. We're going to find out why. And we're going to do something about it. Without boring you with the journey that took us to the passage of the Violence Against Women Act, I can tell you how we went about it. And I think it's important in order to figure how we go from here. I went about it by first getting people to acknowledge that there was a problem. Now, it's kind of hard to believe, but the biggest issue back then in the early 80s was their willingness to recognize this is a problem. Remember when you came and testified that this was a problem? Folks on the left and the right and the center, the one thing I was convinced of, all had to acknowledge first and foremost, before we do anything, that this is a problem. I argued it was a crisis. Because once people acknowledge in our society that a problem exists, then right-minded people, almost regardless of their political disposition, right-minded people will decide how to figure out what to do about the problem, to do something about it. But it really was first, is there a problem? And that's when the next phase of the journey took place. Rather than attempting to do everything that at least I thought we should do about the problem, as chairman, I decided that it was more important to have a unified Congress and a unified nation on the issue than it was to have the perfect bill. Because there were certain things I remember sitting with, as some will remember, with old Strom Thurmond, and saying, literally, look, on this issue, you have to acknowledge there's a problem. Let's agree on what we can agree on to begin the journey to fight the problem, and then we'll go back and fight later about what else has to be done about the problem. Because I know from experience, and unfortunately I have a great deal of experience in that Congress, in the Congress, I know that if you try to do it all, you don't generate a consensus. And the single most important thing is for us to have a cultural consensus that this is a god-awful problem. And so, although from the beginning, as I said, I knew and many of you knew that we had to do something about dating violence or helping victims find long-term housing, for instance, I thought it was more important to establish the principle as a matter of law. Because I had guys saying to me in the Congress, okay, you're right about that, but I'm not going to raise taxes for housing money. I said, okay, no problem. No problem. Just join me in acknowledging the extent of the problem and deal with the core. And quite frankly, it was also a matter of our civic culture that no woman should be victimized purely because someone else had more physical power or more economic power. Now, all of you just take that for granted now. But remember back when we started holding those hearings. Remember how many times I was told by folks, particularly very conservative folks on the right, religious folks, this is a family matter? This is not a national problem. It's interfering with our family values. I thought that was an interesting one. But it was a big deal. But the core principle I wanted, and I think all of you who worked with me back then wanted to establish was, as a matter of law, as a matter of our culture, as a matter of societal value, no one, as my father would say, that the cardinal sin of all sins was the abuse of power. And you should say, this is the ultimate abuse of power. Many of you were my allies in that effort. Many of you really dedicated, brilliant folks in law enforcement. But people don't remember, law enforcement was a great supporter here. Religious groups and women's groups. And I say it all the time, but I want to thank Ellie again and again and again and again. Because there was a coalition of those groups that I just described who didn't want to support the bill at first. Not because they were against it, but because they thought there were other priorities. And I'll never forget going around to my conference table, and Ellie finally looked and said, what are we doing here? Remember that? Why aren't we supporting this? And it changed everything. It changed everything. It's not that people were against it. They just didn't think it was the priority. And guess what? It worked, particularly those of your providers, you know, it worked. It worked in that it began to become part of our culture. It became part of our criminal justice culture. Police departments and prosecutors began to approach these cases very differently in order to hold abusers accountable and to make services available to support those who were being abused and those going through what used to be a double abuse of having to go into a trial system, into a court system, where they'd be abused once again by the system. It became part of our social fabric, our social culture. And the young women were beginning to be taught affirmatively in the public airways, in their homes by their parents, that they were entitled as a matter of right to be free of abuse, that no boy, no man had any right under any circumstances for any reason other than self-defense to raise his hand to a girl or a woman. None. None. No matter what she was wearing, no matter what advance she may have made, that no means no. Means no. It means no in a bar. It means no in a bedroom. It means no in the street. The culture began to change. It also became part of our political culture in that it gained acceptance, wide acceptance, when the act became law in 94. After the first time, American corporations, who prior to this would say, when you came in with a black eye, you saw I ran into the door jamb. Everybody in the office knew your husband beat you again or your boyfriend beat you. You were ashamed to say anything. And they were afraid to acknowledge it because they didn't want your boyfriend coming in the office. They didn't want your husband coming in the office. But they stepped up. Kodak, DuPont, I can name the major corporations. So the culture began to change. But maybe most importantly, the partisan political culture began to change. Although only 7 Republicans voted for this the first time around, second time around, overwhelmingly, Democrats and Republicans supported it. And so the next time the legislation came around for reauthorization, once it was clear that we weren't threatening anybody, that we weren't undoing the family fabric, that we weren't threatening anybody except the people who threatened women, we were able to go further to refine the law, which we knew from the beginning needed further refinement. We were able to add the definition of dating violence and new transitional housing program, which we couldn't have gotten done the first time. And then, on the third authorization, as this took deeper root, we were able to add training for healthcare providers and programs to help children who were witnessing violence at home and get them psychiatric and psychological help. We were able to refine the law because people became confident that this wasn't a tool by the left or a tool by others to seek somehow advantage in relationships. We were able to refine it when the warnings from the former Chief Justice and the Judicial Conference warned when the bill was being debated, remember them warning me as chairman and warning the world, that if Biden's domestic violence law passes, women will use this as leverage in divorce cases. Bizarre. And by the way, if you wonder whether it's important to have women on the federal bench, guess what? A woman from the Third Circuit in Pennsylvania got other women at the conference who were judges and said, this is malarkey. And it changed. It matters. Perspective matters. So, folks, so there's a consensus now in America around our daughters, our sisters, our wives, our mothers, our grandmothers, having the right to expect to be free from violent behavior, particularly the most damaging of all physical violence, is at the hand of someone you know, the hand of someone you trusted, at the hand of someone that forces you to say to yourself, this must be partially my fault. Why didn't I know this? Some of you counselors out there know recovery from stranger rape is about 5 times faster than recovery from rape that occurs as a or abuse occurs at the hands of someone you know. Because you blame yourself. That's part of the sick part of our culture. No one any longer is making the argument that it's a violation of family values. As a matter of fact, it's become sort of a new definition of what constitutes part of a family value, an American family value. But here, the irony of all ironies, as I'm standing before you after 36 years in the Senate as Vice President of the United States with, I mean this sincerely, with the Attorney General being kind enough along with the president to continue to give me authority over choosing who runs these offices. And I mean, this is a generous guy. I'm serious. I don't think it's ever happened before. But that I thought, if you told me that I'd be standing here in 2012, when the law has been in existence over 17 years, when tens of thousands of women and girls have been helped, when police departments now investigate these crimes and put offenders behind bars in almost every instance, when the annual rates of domestic violence have dropped by more than 60%, when states have moved independently and passed over 700 laws among the 50 states to protect victims and hold offenders accountable, when we set up a national hotline that has answered more than 2 million crisis calls and still responds to more than 23,000 calls every month. And go listen. If you have a chance, they'd love to have you come. Go down to the site and listen to that call. They'll put it on a speaker for you. Hello. Hello. I can't speak. My name is Mary. The last one I heard. I'm in this, I forget the mall, it was in Minneapolis. I'm in such and such a mall. I'm standing between. Oh my God, oh my God, he's come, oh my God. I'm standing between Gap and, oh my God, I see him coming. 23,000 calls like that in some version come in every single month. And by the way, imagine the courage it takes to pick up the phone. Just think for a second, all you guys, just think for a second the courage it takes to pick that phone up and dial the number. When we help victims find safe places to stay so they wouldn't have to choose between living on the street or living with someone who is going to continue to hurt them and abuse them. When all that has occurred, the idea we're still fighting about this in the Congress, that this is even a debatable issue, is truly sad. It's not a reflection on the law, it's a reflection on our inability in this town to deal with something that by now should just be over in terms of the debate about it. So the reason I took you through this journey, my purpose here today is to remind everyone just how widely accepted, important, and necessary this law is. I know I'm preaching to the choir, but for the press to hear, what are we arguing about? This shouldn't be hard. As recently as 2003, the last poll I could find, when women were asked what they care about most, 92% American women said reducing domestic violence and sexual assault should be a top priority in America. 92%. I couldn't find a more recent poll, but I would be willing to bet you anything. There's one in 2012. The numbers would not have changed. And look, this is a never-ending fight. You all know this better than I do. And we're still refining, still improving. There's still a lot of work to do. The latest version of the Violence Against Women Act, and Pat Leahy deserves a great deal of credit. The latest version of the act includes help. I realize I've been a pain in the neck about this, but help for schools and colleges to deal with dating violence, since girls in the early 20s face the highest rates of abuse of any women in America. It's going to help law enforcement screen for domestic risk factors that we know lead to domestic violence homicides. And that's going to save lives. And it's going to give police and prosecutors more tools and training to build cases when a victim and the offender know each other, which still remains the most difficult place where we made the least progress, but the least progress is where women are victimized by acquaintances or friends. We're also refining, but we shouldn't be arguing about the core issue of whether or not we should reauthorize the Violence Against Women Act. This has now become, and I would argue proudly, part of the redefinition of our culture. We become identified with this around the world. I travel as much as I think the only person who's traveled more than me is Secretary Clinton. I've traveled over 580,000 miles so far, literally. And I've had the honor of meeting every head of state of consequence in the world. I meet with civic groups in other countries. As much progress as you all know we have to make on women's issues, they look to us. We're trying to export this philosophy to nations where daughters and wives are still victimized. Every day, women still suffer unimaginable horrors across the world, so-called honor killings, acid attacks, dowry-related murders, genital mutilation. We shouldn't be having this debate. And if anyone thinks that this is no longer relevant, and I know none of you do, just look at Sharon. Look at what she went through. My God. This woman has incredible courage. We talked during the trial. I couldn't imagine, Sharon. You had to sit through every detail. You had to relive every day in court. But I'm confident you go to bed at night and pray is purged from your memory. Every day, every detail. You should take some comfort, kiddo, from one thing. You've given solace, strength, hope, and resolve to tens of thousands of other people in this country. But I got to admit to you, frankly, I couldn't have done it. I couldn't have done it. But you did it. And you wonder whether or not this law is necessary. You don't, but some people apparently do. So, folks, we think this law is relevant, as relevant today as it was the day we passed it. That's why, in addition to pushing this reauthorization, we independently, because it's within our administration's power with the leadership of the President and Attorney General, we've independently, because it can't wait, changed once and for all the definition of rape so that all victims who report this brutal violation are counted in our nation's crime statistics and get help. That's why, without going to Congress, we beefed up Title IX so the colleges and universities know it's their responsibility to help bring an end to sexual assault on campuses, and they can't hide it. We expanded the National Dating Abuse Helpline so teens and young adults can reach out through their internet and text messages, the way they communicate, to get help from peers and access to help. And today, the President is directing federal agencies to help employees who are being abused with work for federal agencies to prevent domestic violence in the workplace so that we become a model. Ladies and gentlemen, we're doing this because we know that domestic violence doesn't stay in the home. It spills into the office, the street. It's everywhere. So, folks, the core question in my view is the law still needed? Is it still relevant? And if it is, and the answer seems to me it's absolutely clear that it is, just ask 1 million women who are raped every year, 23,000 women and girls who call the domestic violence hotline. Just ask the young woman in high school or college who still faces the highest rate of dating abuse in the country. Just ask the woman who's beaten right before getting up to go to work and then followed to her job by the man who beat her or threatened her. Nobody should question whether this is needed. But here's what's at stake now. It's not just whether or not we reauthorize this. And I mean this, I feel as strongly about this as anything I have felt on this issue. But these guys don't get. It would have been bad had the law never been passed. But imagine now. Imagine now the message it sends if it's not reauthorized. Just ask yourself, what message will be sent to every one of our daughters, every woman imprisoned in her own home? Just ask yourself what it would say to them if the law is not reauthorized. What would it say to our daughters, our wives, our mothers, about whether or not they are entitled to respect and their government believes they're entitled to be free of this violence? About whether or not they're entitled merely because they were born. They were entitled to be free of violence and abuse. Folks, this wasn't the end I ever envisioned with the passage of this legislation. I envisioned the ultimate result of this legislation, the Supreme Court got in the way in taking away the civil right cause of action in federal court. But I envisioned this legislation as a refinement that it would lead to be a basis on which we could teach our daughters and our sons that it's absolutely positively socially unacceptable to engage in behavior that threatens, condones, or turns a blind eye to physical abuse. That's how ultimately we're going to end this abuse. That's how we'll meet the goal that every single solitary woman and girl in America is entitled to be free of abuse of any kind. It's a fundamental shift in attitude. The moral disapprobation of society is the only thing that ultimately changes behavior, in my view. And just imagine the impact on the moral disapprobation of society if this Congress refuses to reauthorize the Violence Against Women Act. You know, I thank you all for being here, not just today, but I look out and I see an awful lot of friends. An awful lot of you taught me a great deal. I thought I came to this fight equipped, and I thought I knew a great deal about it. And I think I did, but you taught me so much more. Some of you heard me say, there's nothing in my career, my public life or private life, I've been more proud to be associated with than with all of you in this effort to deal with, as my father would say, the cardinal sin of all sins, the abuse of power. I think we have to appeal to the better angels of our friends up in the Hill. I mean it sincerely. Because I believe, even those guys and women opposing this, I think in their hearts, they know this is the right thing. And so I ask you, in addition to what you're already doing, the groups you represent, appeal to their better angels. Remind them. Remind them some of them have daughters. They have spouses. They have significant others. And this matters. Dealing with this issue is one woman, one girl, one person at a time. It's not about big numbers. It's the quintessential personal issue. And every single case is different. But every case is similar in one respect. If you are victimized, somebody is abusing a physical or financial or psychological power over you that is the ugliest sin that man can commit. So, folks, I think I'm always referred to as the Attorney General can tell you at cabinet meetings or other places, the White House optimist. I am an optimist because I believe the history of the journey of this country has been, it has always moved toward personal freedom. Always. It's sometimes slid back, but it's always moved forward. So with the help of Valerie Jarrett and the Attorney General's office and leaders like all of you, I'm confident that if we just keep people's eye on the ball, we'll be able to get this done. But it is an irony that a law that overwhelmingly has worked is now being questioned, whether or not it should be reauthorized. We can't let that happen. With your help, I don't think it will happen. And for all of you who are providers, all of you who are involved with caring for and intervening on behalf of and helping the women out there, all you law enforcement officers, all you folks running the shelters, all you folks who are engaged in the nursing profession, who are and doctors who have become much more attuned, so I want to say thank you. My mom used to have an expression, if she were here, she'd look at y'all and say, you're doing God's work. You really are doing God's work. Thanks an awful lot. See y'all later.